it's an emergent area of interest for a lot of people, and I think it's so ingrained in our daily life.
One way you can do that with polytrained athletes is take them to
those tiny babies.
And I guess for every day when I'm working
with patients, we expect a baby to look like.
It is a topic which is often highly emotive.
Think.
This is Think Help on 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome to Think Health, where we cultivate and articulate the best in health research. I'm Ellen Liebeder and you're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. Today, how social media is changing the health profession and helping patients in recovery. But first on the show today...
Well, I get massages from an osteopath and I have done acupuncture.
I've had acupuncture.
I've used fish oil. I've taken supplements like multivitamins, taking those. I've had a massage before, yeah.
So I've done some acupuncture in the past, and I guess at home I practice some aromatherapy and herbal medicine.
If you have ever dabbled in acupuncture, aromatherapy, herbal medicines, chiropractics, massage, vitamins or minerals, you have used complementary or alternative medicine. It's one of the more polarising issues in healthcare, with most people hung up on the question of do these treatments work? Earlier this year, a draft review into complementary medicine set up by the former Labor government reported that many of these treatments have no evidence to support their effectiveness. But Professor John Adams argues that this is the wrong approach. Professor Adams is a director of the Australian Research Centre in Complementary Integrative Medicine, or ARCHEM, in the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology, Sydney.
What's interesting about the space of complementary medicine and researching it is that it is a topic which is often highly emotive. People are very there's a lot of political commentary about this topic. What ARCHEM at UTS is doing and really leading the world with advancing is an idea that we need to take a critical, rigorous scientific approach to understanding these broad research questions, which are not just about does it work, but are also about questions about how and why people use it, what decisions they make, information. So what many people go straight to in terms of asking research questions is the question of why does it work? Does complementary medicine work? So these are questions of efficacy. Is complementary medicine effective? They're very good questions to ask. That's a very good focus. And a lot of people are spending a lot of hard-earned time and resources trying to answer that question. However, one of the things I became aware of very early in my career was that to just focus exclusively on that question misses a lot of other very rich data that can help inform good, safe, effective healthcare provision and service around these topics. So one of the things we're keen on here at ARCHEM and at UTS is to provide oxygen and advance and promote a very complementary but somewhat different and broader way of thinking about complementary medicines. This is a topic which is incredibly barren. It's like a big black hole in terms of complementary medicine use in the community. It's often very hidden and covert. So what our centre at ARCHEM is trying to do is to address and provide at least the beginning of empirical data.
In light of the does it work debate, ARCHEM has been researching who uses complementary medicine and why.
The use of complementary medicine is certainly not restricted to a particular section of the community. For example, it was often portrayed maybe a decade or two ago that this was just an indulgence of people with disposable income, the middle classes, who probably just wanted to feel good and have a massage or undertake some other kind of therapy. That is not the case, and I don't think has been the case for a long time. What empirical data is showing across Australia and also other countries is that this is a diverse use, which is used across most sectors of the community. It's used both in urban and rural Australia. It's used by men and women, and it's used with different health conditions. Not all, obviously. Some are more pertinent than others. Probably chronic illness is a high use area, and there's a number of other topics as well. But it is very broad brushstroke now in terms of prevalence and the profile of people.
One interesting point from Professor Adams' research is that people who use complementary medicine don't always tell their GPs.
Did you tell your GP?
No.
Why didn't you tell your GP?
Because I felt it was a separate issue.
Why would I? Why do I need to tell my GP if I'm taking fish oil? I don't feel the need to tell my GP that sort of thing.
Well, I had it done in Singapore when I didn't have a sort of GP relationship. I guess if I was doing it here where I do have a relationship with a GP, I might well discuss it with him first.
Yeah, actually my GP knows that I'm more into, naturopathy, etc. So generally she doesn't really offer me scripts any longer.
One of the things that consistently the literature has shown, our work as well as others around the world, shows that patients don't always communicate to doctors very well about what they're using beyond the conventional care they're being provided by that individual. So they may be using a whole vast array of complementary medicines, but for a whole host of reasons, not mention it to the doctor. Equally, literature has shown that there's a substantial number of general practitioners or conventional doctors out there that equally often don't ask questions or inquire about their patients' use of complementary medicine. Now, you can imagine some of the risks and potential problems and challenges that poses for a healthcare system and provision to be safe, effective, and coordinated. In terms of GPs themselves, it's a very broad church. There are some sections of the general practice community in Australia who are very keen and interested in complementary medicine and knowing more about it, whether it's simply in terms of the welfare of their patients or they take a clinical interest in it.
Dr. Brian Morton is Chair of the Council of General Practice at the Australian Medical Association and has been a GP for almost 40 years. He says GPs should assume most of their patients use complementary medicine.
I suspect that most patients, certainly the elderly or those with chronic diseases, are actually trying complementary medicine. Whether they tell me or not, I'm not so sure. I think most are taking some form. Sometimes it's only a vitamin, but others can be more significant.
And why do you think patients are afraid to tell their GP what else they're taking?
I think patients assume that because it's called a natural product, it's safe and is, you know, maybe like taking a vitamin or sort of a tonic of the old days. So they assume that they don't need to tell the doctor. And sometimes they assume, you know, I don't know how we'd know without them telling us, but they make assumptions. I think that's the most common thing, that we as GPs have to assume everyone's taking one and we ought to be doing the asking.
Not only do people not tell their GPs, but often those that see GPs are more likely to self-prescribe complementary medicine. Professor Adams again.
The study you're referring to was an Australian Research Council-funded study by the government. We were very fortunate to get some major national funding. That was a national cohort of women with back pain, and it was looking at, through a mixed methodology, a whole range of issues around their care, who they sought care from, who they went to first, who they subsequently consulted with about their back pain. Can I just say that the issue you raise about seeing a GP first and then self-prescribing, that gets to the heart of the issue we were talking about previously, about disclosure, about information and communication, which is the fact that now you've got that information from some empirical work, we need to do more work to work out what are the challenges of that situation now we've identified it. What does that mean for the GP, for the patient, and also not just self-prescribe, but often these women with back pain will be seeking other help concurrently to a GP as well. Will they be informing their GP about this other use? Maybe not.
It goes without saying, of course, that if you are using alternative medicines, you should probably tell your GP.
Most of those don't in fact have evidence to support their use, yet patients are naive to think that it's safe. And it's very important for patients to actually tell their doctor what they're taking, because complementary medicines can interfere with conventional medicines, and that can be disastrous for some conditions.
This research is important for policymakers when planning healthcare options.
You can see that the types of benefits and insights you get there could be useful for all range of people, not just the patients and the providers, but people planning and funding healthcare more generally. About, you know, if we want to eradicate inconsistencies, ineffective care, we want to make care more coordinated and safe, we need to know about everything that everyone is using, and we need to be able to make good policy changes or developments based on hard evidence in each topic. And that's really what we're starting to do with these types of areas, is to uncover empirically what's going on that we previously didn't know anything about.
Looking into the use of these treatments is going to become more interesting come April this year, when the government is set to release its review into alternative medicine. The review is reported to not only deny evidence that complementary medicine works, but that government subsidies for these treatments from private health insurance should be scrapped.
You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Heard of Dr. Google, but now social media sites like Twitter and Facebook are joining the fray when it comes to health promotion. Health organisations are embracing social media to remind you to go for that run, but they are also changing the way survivors of various illnesses and even health professionals themselves interact. Caleb Ferguson is a lecturer at the University of Technology Sydney and an avid tweeter. He spoke to me about how social media can best be harnessed by the health profession.
It's an emergent area of interest for a lot of people, and I think it's so ingrained in our daily life that people are really looking at how we can use this best in health. And there tends to be a lot of international leaders in that space, and it's gaining recognition as an important area in healthcare and how we can use these technologies and apply them to healthcare. So it's really exciting times. And then like every day there seems to be a newer platform, and people are sort of experimenting and testing how we can best integrate that into healthcare. It's very exciting at the moment. Yeah.
It feels as though Twitter and Facebook have been around for quite a while, though. The health profession a bit late to get on the bandwagon?
Yeah, probably. And I think I've written before, I think that whole sort of, we're quite a risk-averse population, and that culture around risk, and there's all these concerns. And historically, a lot of what was written in the literature and what you'll see about is nurses, you know, naughty nurses on social media, and then really breaches in privacy and confidentiality, and all these concerns around health professionals doing the wrong thing on social media. It's nice to see that now it's gaining recognition as a sort of validated platforms for health professionals to use, and really as an alternate medium to engage with patients as well. And that seems to be really the direction that's going, is how can we use these forums to engage with patients more as well.
Yeah. Would you be able to give us some examples of how you're using these platforms to engage with patients?
Yeah, so there's 10 that I'd just like to go back a little bit, but the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media in the US is really leading the way in terms of developments in this area, and they've been a really key figure for a lot of people internationally. And they're running a social media summit in Brisbane. It's the first international summit on social media and healthcare in Brisbane in September, and that'll be 3 days where health professionals and social media experts come together to really look at different ways in which people are using social media. It's quite exciting. But yeah, to go back to the question, I think that there's lots of different ways it's being used today, and it could even be things like advocacy programs to increase, say, organ donation rates and increase the sort of public awareness of different health topics as well. So if you look at something like the American Heart Association, are quite really engaged with platforms around like Twitter and Facebook in particular, and using them to really engage with consumers, health professionals, patients, communities around spreading positive health messages. So health promotion messages around, say, physical activity, healthy eating, diet and all that sort of thing. And locally in Australia as well, I'm also an ambassador for the National Stroke Foundation. But they use Twitter and Facebook in a really positive way, and they really engage with stroke survivors and patients and clinicians, researchers, and really have developed this really nice community on Twitter, have quite a massive following. But it's not really that. So a lot of associations and institutions are really using these mediums as a one-way push of information, but they really use it in a nice, engaging two-way conversation. So their media comms person's really engaged with that community, and it's really grown over the last few years. And it's nice to see people now sort of sharing their stories around their experiences of, say, living with stroke. And before, you know, there might have been a hospital sort of support group that someone could go along to physically and once a week to sort of help with living with stroke stuff and some information. And now it's nice that you don't have that physical barrier, and you might have trouble getting into the hospital and the ambulance or patient transport to get there, and it might be quite a day trip to go to the recovery group sort of thing.
And I suppose it's also good for people in rural areas too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, totally. And all those disparities around, it's great us sitting here in Sydney in a metropolitan area that we have all these services here, but think of someone that lives out the back of Bourke and had their stroke at Coonabarabran and just doesn't have those recovery facilities. So for them to be able to tap into some of the expertise that we have in the city regions is really exciting.
But it's not just patients. I know you recently researched how Twitter was used at the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand meeting. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
So, yeah, I've written a paper and we did some analytics behind what people were talking about and how they were using Twitter. And it tends to be that cardiovascular professionals in Australia and globally have kind of really harnessed that technology and Twitter as a platform quite well. And around conference use, there tends to be a lot of backroom chatter sort of going on. And now you'll see people on their phones, head down, but also engaging with what the presentation is about, but also having some critical discussion behind the scenes. So we really just looked at trends and looked at frequency of use and who some really basic analytics behind the conversation. Yeah, and it's moved from where, like in terms of networking, you know, the old-fashioned way of standing with business cards next to a poster and a conference with your cup of tea to now you're just looking at the hashtag, who are the key influencers on that hashtag for the conference, and you can connect with them on Twitter or follow them and really engage with experts as well that you wouldn't normally have access to. So it could be people, really key experts from say Glasgow or the US or Europe, and really having instant access and conversations with them. So it's exciting.
And also it gives you opportunity to really disseminate that information to a much broader audience. I think one of the things you were talking about in this research was that one of your tweets was retweeted by a celebrity and it got about 980,000 impressions.
Yeah, this was from one of the accounts we looked at was from a cardiologist, and he was successful in regaining a retweet from I'll keep it anonymous, but from a high profile celebrity actor. And I think that shows and that really demonstrates the powerfulness in terms of advocacy for a health topic. So you know, for him to have a retweet by this high-profile guru on about that topic was really powerful in spreading that message as well, and just reaching out to like a general population. And I think as well that's where, say, Twitter is quite useful and other mediums as well. But to break down the barrier in terms of engaging with patients and caregivers at home, whereas outside of the clinic, and before health professions have been really resistant to you know, using these mediums, and there's all these health systems barriers around about, say, you know, 6 minute medicine. You're going to see your GP, you have 6 minutes, and you have a cost code allocated for that activity. Well, in Australia, we don't have a cost code that I'm aware of for, say, a Skype consultation with a GP. But for many, that might be now the preferred option that they would like, or to have an email conversation with your GP about a very minor ailment that you might just need a referral to a specialist or a repeat prescription and that sort of thing. Yeah.
So technology is going to be used in probably a very different way to, say, the way our parents viewed their GPs. What else is going to be happening for technology in the health profession in the next couple of years?
I think we'll see quite a huge change in terms of how people use the technologies. I still think that health is behind in terms of other industries that have recognised the need to really get on board with social media and the powerfulness of it, if you want to term it that way. But I think eventually, you know, we're looking at a huge change in the way that services could be delivered. And I think it's just about recognising the complexities that exist around this in terms of some of the barriers to uptake, and looking at solutions in terms of how we could best integrate this new technology into our practice.
Caleb Ferguson from the University of Technology Sydney there.
Think.
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 You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Find out more about how social media is helping patients. I spoke to Adrian O'Malley, who is an ambassador for the National Stroke Foundation. Adrian suffered a stroke 8 years ago at age 34 and regularly uses the National Stroke Foundation's Facebook page to connect with other stroke survivors.
I was 34. My wife was heavily pregnant, and I woke up on a Saturday morning and made her a cup of tea, and I said, "I think you better take me to hospital. I don't feel right." And I got out of hospital 10 weeks later with a stroke and a heart operation. And yes, that was completely unexpected and very much out of the blue. And in my 9 weeks in hospital, I had to learn to walk again. I'd lost my vision on my right side. So it's not that I'm blind in my right eye. I'm half blind in both my eyes. So I've lost my right vision. And luckily, I'm left-handed because my right hand is not very useful.
That must have been very hard to deal with when your wife was pregnant as well.
It was. It focused the mind, I guess, because I didn't want my wife to have two bums to wipe and two mouths to feed and two nappies to change. So I wanted to get as well as I could in as short a time as I could so that I could be useful and I could be a dad, and that child could have a dad that participates in her upbringing. So I got out of hospital a week later. A little girl was put in my arms, and my job was done. As I say, I could walk again by that point, and I was upright and able to participate, and I could learn how to change nappies one-handed and all that kind of stuff. And that little girl's 8 now, and she's a fabulous human being.
34 is quite a young age to have a stroke. How did that make you feel at the time?
As I say, it was completely out of the blue, and I knew nothing about stroke. So I had a lot of learning to do. How did it make me feel? Confronted, I guess. I like a challenge. But as I say, that, you know, the fact, you know, if anyone out there is planning to have a stroke, have it in your early 30s. When you're about to have a child as well, because that's a motivation to get well. So it was a challenge, absolutely it was a challenge, but I've got the rest of my life to get used to it. I'm going to be a patient of some sort or another for the rest of my life. So I figured, I drew a line in the sand very early on in the piece and understood that was my life.
So how long after your stroke did you start using social media to connect with other stroke survivors?
2006 doesn't seem very long ago, but when I was in hospital, people didn't have smartphones. So it was only after I got out of hospital and got home and on a computer, and I started interacting with the National Stroke Foundation Facebook page. When I first started interacting, it was a community in its hundreds, and I've watched it grow to thousands. It's now just sitting over 10,000. And I've always felt it's a good resource, and it's well run in that it celebrates successes, and it is a great source of information and connection for people who've had a stroke, because stroke is and can be socially isolating for people. You had a life prior to your stroke where, you know, you had interactions with people, you might have been able to hop in the car and drive places. When you have a stroke, suddenly you have a before and after life, and your life after stroke is different. And your friends carry on their lives while you get bogged down in doing rehabilitation and attending medical appointments. So in terms of connecting people, social isolation and social interaction is really important for people with stroke.
And how often do you use social media today, 8 years later?
I did try to use Twitter, but I found it was completely banal. I couldn't get it. The National Stroke Foundation asked me if I would get a Twitter account, and I did, and I absolutely didn't like that. So I just stick to Facebook, and it's a daily occurrence for me. I might not post anything, but I'm always interested in seeing what's going on and seeing what people are up to, because that community has grown, as I say, from hundreds to you know, a little over 10,000 now. But I still feel, in terms of the impact of stroke, that the community isn't representative of the real world, where stroke happens to one in six people, and a stroke happens every 10 minutes. Just out of curiosity, I did a little bit of research before we started this interview. In terms of the size of the community for the National Stroke Foundation Facebook page, as I say, it's about 10,000 odd, and the more obscure things that I looked at, the sadder I got. The New South Wales Cat Protection Society has more likes. The Greyhound Rescue has more likes. If stroke happened to boobs or bums, stroke would matter more in the community, but it's not cute, and it's not fluffy, and it's not cuddly. Stroke is sad, and it's debilitating, and it affects not just the individual, it affects the people around them, and it's not sexy. So unfortunately, the community is not as big as it should be, because it's not representative of the actual impact in the community.
What's the general response to recent stroke survivors who log on and see this community and start becoming a part of it?
Welcome, and you're not alone, and celebrate your successes. And one of the things that I love about it is that people ask questions and are not afraid to ask questions. Every stroke is different, you know. My effects are different to your effects. But don't be afraid to ask questions. It's a welcoming community in that way. And it's a good resource. It's a good, you know, group knowledge is power. I think, you know, if nothing else, if one or two of the people that are listening to this interview think, I'll go and have a look at their Facebook page and like it, that'd be great, you know. That'd be a thumbs up from me. I can't give two thumbs up because only one hand works, so one thumbs up from me.
That was Adrian O'Malley, a stroke survivor and ambassador for the National Stroke Foundation. If you would like to find out more about that story or any of the other stories you heard today, head to our website at 2ser.com/thinkhealth. Next week on Think Health, we're looking at sport, how to help athletes perform better, and why your birthday may affect your sporting potential. This show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney Faculty of Health. I'm Ellen Liebeder. This has been Think Health. See you next week for more in health research.